This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we honor Black History Month with the new book on Paul Robeson called Ballad of an American, a graphic biography of Paul Robeson.
A great book and a great person. Check this out.
Noted legal authority Stephen Rohde joins us as we begin impeachment week.
Will the Republicans have the courage and integrity to vote guilty on Donald Trump?
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
Paul Robeson, like John Brown before him and Malcolm X after him, was an American of great courage and great accomplishments. Like John Brown and Malcolm, the powers that be vilified him and attempted to reduce him to obscurity. Robeson was born the son of a slave in Somerville, New Jersey in 1898. At Rutgers University, he was a Phi Beta Kappa, graduated at the top of his class, and delivered the valedictorian speech. He won 16 letters in sports, football, baseball, track and field, and basketball. He had a beautiful bass voice and sang in the choir. He briefly played professional football and graduated from Columbia Law School. He was an outstanding actor, performing on both stage and screen in America and England. As a concert performer, he traveled the world, singing spirituals, labor songs, and folk songs of American blacks. Robeson was outspoken in support of civil rights, union struggles, anti-colonialism, and he asserted himself as a socialist. Because of this, he was repressed by the reactionary forces in America in a period of time after World War II, known as McCarthyism. In August 1949, a concert he was to headline in Peekskill, New York, was broken up by fascists. The next year, a national concert tour had to be canceled because theaters refused to book him. His passport was taken away. He couldn't travel. He was told he could have it back if he promised not to, quote, criticize the treatment of American Negroes in the U.S., which should not be aired abroad. Robeson was called before the House Un-American Activities Committee in 1956 and asked why he didn't stay in Russia. He replied, quote, because my father was a slave and my people died to build this country and I'm going to stay here. His films and recordings were taken out of circulation and he disappeared from textbooks and halls of fame. Of Paul Robeson, Cornel West has said that, quote, he was an artistic genius, moral titan, and courageous freedom fighter whom we must never forget. We speak today with Sharon Rudall, who did the art and wrote the text for the recently published graphic biography, Paul Robeson, Ballad of an American. The book was edited by Paul Buell and Lawrence Ware. Sharon Rudolph marched with Martin Luther King as a teenager and began her career as a cartoonist with anti-Vietnam War underground newspapers. She was one of the founders of the 1970s-era feminist women's comics, and she's best known for her graphic biography, Emma Goldman, A Dangerous Woman. Sharon Rudolph, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Sharon, congratulations on your marvelous achievement in writing and drawing Ballad of an American, a graphic biography of Paul Robeson. The scholarship that went into it and your artistry are wonderful. Was this a labor of love?
Well, when I began it, I was already past 70 and thinking of myself as partially retired, that if an interesting or lucrative assignment came by, I wouldn't turn it down. But I wasn't looking for anything as massive as this. But Paul Buell, who's edited a lot of my work, approached me and asked me to do it. And I think on the basis of just my being an unreconstructed old lefty commie type person that was also a pretty good artist. And it went on from there. I don't know if labor of love really describes it as much as a sense that, you know, this had been handed to me at a time that I didn't think I had any more important work in me, and it was still on my shoulders to do the very best I could do. And I definitely felt my real deadline was not so much mortality, but you may not realize how physically taxing it is to do something like that long form without using a computer. I mean, that my hand would stay steady, that my eyes would stay clear enough, that my back would stay strong enough to do justice to Paul Robeson. So every morning I would get up, you know, like at 4 a.m. and either research or take notes or get prepare for the part of the day that was the actual physical labor of doing it, and not know how many days I had. So if that comes through somehow in the product, I'm happy.
It does. But before we talk about Paul Robeson, Sharon, tell us about his parents, please.
Okay, so his mother and father were both slaves. Not his mother, I'm sorry. His father was a slave in North Carolina, and when his father escaped from slavery, he came back twice, risking to be taken back into slavery in order to see his mother. And I have two adult sons, so that was something that really, really mattered to me. It really seemed like, I can't imagine a son nowadays risking that for their mother. I'm sure there's people that would, but anyways, I was really touched by that. And his father, after he escaped, worked his way through theological school and became a pastor, and he married a school teacher of mixed racial ancestry, which, that was something else I discovered in the course of the book, how many more of my characters were of mixed ancestry than I would have believed. Native American, Jewish American, all kinds of different backgrounds. And of course, at that time and even into my childhood, there was that old touch of the tar brush that if you even had one relative that was black, you had no choice except to stay in the black community. I mean, I guess some people pass, but by and large, that's what you were, that was your life, you know, even if you were very much the sort of person nowadays that would be just considered an ordinary resident of Los Angeles, you know. But no, you either white or you were some subclass. So that was the background. And he was the last child of a fairly large family. Paul Robeson was. His parents were already middle aged when he was born, and his mother was already in poor health when he was born.
Paul Robeson's achievements at Rutgers University are nothing short of spectacular. Please talk about him both as an athlete, a scholar, and also as a singer.
He received, Paul Robeson did 15 varsity letters in 4 different sports, and he achieved a Phi Beta Kappa scholar, and he was elected to be the valedictorian of his 1919 class. So he was pretty much at the top and very much respected and admired. He also sang in the Rutgers chorus, but let me find the place for that. Okay, so I'll quote from, this is page 23. With his soul-stirring bass-bass baritone, Paul was a star of the Rutgers Glee Club, but he could not go with the club to off-campus social gatherings. And I have Paul outside this Victorian atrium where you see silhouettes of people dancing and musical notes, and he's thinking, there was a clear line, and this is a quote, there was a clear line beyond which one did not pass. So with the team and with his teams and with his singing, he still had to be segregated from the white community.
Although he went to Columbia Law School, he really didn't practice law much, did he?
No, it was actually, he got that job through a Rutgers alumni. Rutgers remained important through most of his life as far as connections that he made and certain crucial incidents. He was hired by a boss who had some connections with Rutgers, but thought that if Paul actually practiced law, that the white clients wouldn't want to be seen with a black lawyer in court. So he was sort of immured in the law library doing research, and he was subject to racist treatment. Some secretary or file clerk or whatever at the law firm, he asked them to help with his research, and the response is, I won't work for a nigger. And that was the end of his wanting to have a law career.
Sharon, please talk about Paul Robeson in relation to the Harlem Renaissance.
Okay, now this is a question that is one of the ones you gave me in advance, so I had a little chance to think about it. But, you know, the thing is, I don't think that Paul Robeson thought of himself as the leading light in the Harlem Renaissance. It was already going on when he got to Harlem, the quote, the Negro capital of the world, and he was already known to all the movers and shakers there as a great athlete, fine musician, someone that got great press in the white media, and he was welcomed, and he immediately was invited to the A-list parties and embraced by the Harlem community. At that time, the thing I wanted to bring up about Harlem at that time, there was this idea, fairly common, of the talented tenth, that if around a tenth of the black community could become successful in their careers, educated, good examples, that would be enough to uplift the race as a whole, that white society would begin to respect them. And of course, that became clear over not that many years that it just wasn't happening. They became like tokens without really making life better for the majority of black people. And Paul became much more radicalized afterward. But at the time that he was in Harlem, I think that was a fairly common line of thought espoused by the people that he was with. Oh, here's I found the place of the law firm. Okay. He goes into the back. Miss Jackson, this is Paul talking. Miss Jackson, could you please take down this document? And the secretary at the law firm says, I don't take dictation from a nigger. And then the boss says, young man, I've been thinking about opening an office in Harlem. You'd be more comfortable working with your own people. And at that point, he hadn't really been that excited about a law career anyway, as far as I can tell. But at that point, he just walked out and couldn't take it anymore.
Heidi and I appreciated your writing about Essie Good, Paul Robeson's wife. She was an accomplished woman in her own right. And you brought this out in the book. Please talk about Essie Good.
I'm really happy you noticed that, because this is something I found across my career of doing nonfiction work, mostly with Paul Boole, that if there's a woman character or a wife or whatever that has mostly been ignored, I find out all these wonderful things about them that nobody's bothered to find out. And why didn't anybody notice that? She was the first black staff member at New York Presbyterian Hospital. She worked as a technician. She could have become a doctor or a scientist if she hadn't had to deal with racism. She was a woman of extremely intelligence and drive. She had dropped her job at the lab at one point to become Paul's manager and agent. This had a lot of resonance for me because going through the underground cartoonist movement and, you know, who became stars, who won the Pulitzer Prize? Well, guess what? They're the ones who had wives like Essie Good. They sat in the back room drinking and drawing, and their Essie Goods actually got them seen and published and things accomplished. I think that's an aspect of sexism that we have not yet faced up to, how much it really does take two people to make a career, and the one that doesn't have their name remembered has always been the woman. You know, when women get husbands who are able to give them the kind of support that these women gave Paul Robeson and later cartoonists who remain unnamed, they won't be able to achieve what they could otherwise. It takes a village to make a successful artist. Oh, and here's a digression I actually prepared for you. All these interviews I've been doing about the book the last few months have jogged some of my memories about my work, and I remembered a conversation I had with a woman illustrator sometime in the mid-1970s when I had only been being published for not that many years and making a living as an artist, doing some technical illustration and stuff on the side and teaching and whatever, but nonetheless making a living as an artist. And I think it's very relevant to your listeners that, you know, we have this idea of the artist is this man that pours out his heart, and if he ruins other people's lives, well, it's all worth it for his art. And what I said to my friend, tidied up and said more neatly now, is I feel being an artist is like being an astronaut, that you go forth, whether it's into inner space or outer space, and you encounter amazing sights that almost very few other people get to see, but you don't go by yourself. You know, there's a space program that people have paid taxes or that have bought books or that paid museum admissions. There's the people that made your capsule and the people that made your spacesuit and the people that prepared the food for you to eat. If you have this privilege of going out into space and seeing amazing sights, they all go with you. You're their scout. You're their envoy. You have to bring back what will please them or amuse them or touch them or comfort them or instruct them or be useful to them. You can't forget that they're all traveling with you. And that's what I still believe about the role of an artist.
Essie and Robeson spent a decade in London. Would you say that it was there that he got politically radicalized and active?
In London, one of his experiences in England that was very strong was that there was much less racism than in the United States. And in fact, during his stay there, when there began to be more racism in terms of him being excluded from certain clubs and restaurants and such, it was supposed to be because of American tourists that the British were forced to do that. And my take on that is not that British civilization is so much more enlightened about race, but that they have such a strict class system that, you know, people are able to exercise whatever pleasure it is they get out of looking down on other people by their accents or their class origins, and they didn't have to expend as much energy on looking down on other people because of the color of their skin. So that made it possible for Paul Robeson to move more easily in society and amongst, I mean, he knew people like H.G. Wells and, you know, Rebecca West, all the movers and shakers of left-wing British society in the time that he was there, and he got to see all the expat revolutionaries like Emma Goldman and Nehru and Mei Lianfang, the Chinese revolutionary. But something that was very important in my creating the book, I mean, when you make a book out of something, I'm not saying that people always do this, but you know, I wanted to make it a story that made sense, and it was really important to me to find some sort of storytelling clue of what made him become more radicalized. And what I actually based it on was just a footnote in the main academic history of his life, Duberman's book. It's a footnote that in 1928 he joined Welsh miners in a demonstration, and later he became very involved with the movements of the Welsh miners and sang with them. But anyway, I wanted to pick a point at which he went from hanging out with these left-wing British intellectuals and members of parliament who didn't really bother to get their hands dirty to being a real revolutionary. And what I chose was this footnote of him joining the Welsh miners. And it also gave me an opportunity to express something that was really important to me in Paul's life of struggle and in my own belief that, you know, anything that divides us from seeing who our true oppressors are, anything that makes us fight with each other, anything that limits our solidarity, we're doing the oppressors' work. We're making it easier for them. And it was really important to me to bring that out and say it. It seems so broad in Paul's life that he identified with anybody's struggle, with anybody who was oppressed. Let me just read you a little bit of this after he goes off in the demonstration. The parliamentarians he's hanging out with say, well, he says, shouldn't you be doing something about how the Welsh miners are not being allowed to form unions and such? And they say, sorry, old chap, we keep our seats thanks to the English miners. I didn't know that was true, but it seems so much like what the people in Congress do. I assumed that they did the same thing there. Okay, so I'm quoting the book now. The Welsh miners were the blackest white men Paul had ever met. Not only were the miners' skins blackened by coal, but they did the hardest, most dangerous work for low wages. Their children often went hungry and had no decent schools or medical care. The miners worked without safety gear and died young. Their sons followed them into the mines, while the mine owners and their stockholders got richer day by day. And you see like some cartoon capitalists with a ticker tape and stuff. And Paul's back at home thinking and seeing like a Ku Klux Klan cross-burning, and he's thinking while as he sleeps, what if behind the thug mobs of racism there were more powerful mob bosses? And you see that the Ku Klux Klan, they're actually like puppets, and the people that are holding the puppet strings are these capitalists in top hats. Gang lords who stirred up and took advantage of racism. And now we see it's based on a Goya etching, the capitalists are eating the working people. As long as working people could be divided by fear and hatred, blinded to their true enemies, the gang bosses would feast in peace on the lives of the poor. And I think Paul came to see that. I don't think it was probably one flashing inside the way I made it in the book, but it seems pretty clear that he came to believe that and that his struggle was with and for everyone that was oppressed. I was talking about Essie and how what she did for Paul was similar to what I saw some of the wives of the cartoonists do, but she also was an artist and writer in her own right, and she would always photograph and take notes whenever they traveled, and she published a book of her photographs in Africa that was very well reviewed. She was an extraordinary woman.
Perhaps Robeson's finest role on the stage was playing the part of Othello in Shakespeare's great play. What was the plot, and why do you think Paul was perfectly cast as Othello?
I actually don't think Paul was any more perfectly cast than any other excellent black actor. The important thing about his having the role of Othello was that no black actor had been allowed to play Othello. It was all played by white actors in blackface. Ira Aldridge was Othello in the mid-19th century. No black actor had played Othello since Ira Aldridge in the mid-19th century. Okay. In 1603, Shakespeare wrote a character of African descent more believable than any written by white authors in Robeson's lifetime. And that's important to me because what I wrote first was that Shakespeare wrote a more realistic black character or a more real black character than any of the white authors in Robeson's lifetime. And then I thought, how do I know? I don't know what a real black man is. I don't have any right to say that. So I said more believable. And I'm comfortable with that because some of the modern plays were just so, you know, ridiculous exaggerations with all this Freudian nonsense and stuff. There are parallels to Paul's life in the Othello story, but there are parallels in almost anyone of an oppressed group to Othello's story. He's a hero, and he's made lionized, but then because he is someone that the society is prejudiced against, it's easy for an enemy to play on his fears and doubts and make him paranoid. I actually don't think that there's that much comparison between Othello and Paul Robeson, except that they're both black men and that Paul Robeson was actually able to play him on Broadway for the first time, not just somebody in blackface.
Paul Annesi came back to the United States in 1937. What did he get involved in politically and artistically then?
Okay, Andre. Once he had made that step to being a progressive leader or progressive supporter, rather, willing to show up for any kind of fundraising or, you know, getting people to demonstrate. I have a big panel here of just some of the things he did. In aid of unemployed workers, Welsh National Memorial to honor our fallen in Spain. He did a lot of stuff. He went to Spain in the French Civil War. The Spanish Civil War against Franco. He was demonstrations for world peace, trade unions, boycotts, Basque Children's Committee, Food for Spain, Free Africa. He became involved in African Liberation Movement before anybody else had even heard of it. Save China when China was being invaded. He just threw himself into anything that could be useful.
The FBI and the McCarthy witch hunters feared Paul Robeson as a dangerous black socialist. What did they do to try to bring him down?
I mean, it's more what didn't they do. They took away his passport so he couldn't travel to perform. They kept any venues from being able to have him show up, whether it was just to newspapers or actually closing the doors. They disappeared him from any books or publications or radio shows or anything that in which he featured. They shut up any opportunities for him to make himself known to the public, and I think that continues to some extent to this day. After he was barred from travel overseas in 1952, he was also barred from travel to Canada, which did not yet require a passport. So he used to give annual concerts at the border, at the Peace Wall, the Peace Arch at the border of Canada and the U.S., and he would sing so people could be on both sides of the border and listen to him, his magnificent voice.
Paul Robeson, Sharon, really quite a magnificent figure, and he has emerged from the obscurity they tried to consign him to, pretty much. Please talk about how this ultimately failed and how he has been honored.
Well, I am going to read you some of the honors that have occurred lately for him, but I have to say I'm afraid they haven't failed, because when I talk about this book or encounter people and mention Paul Robeson, people that are much younger than us, by and large, still haven't heard of him. And I don't see, this is Black History Month, I don't see him being honored and brought to the forefront as he deserves to be. I'm afraid what they tried to do to him and blacken his name and cut him off from his people, I'm afraid it was more successful than it should have been, and it kind of falls to us to continue to tell people about him and revive his memory and make them aware of what a magnificent pioneer he was. Let's see. But here are some of the things that have happened in recent decades. In 1978, James Earl Jones performed a one-man Broadway show about him. In 1979, Sidney Poitier won an Academy Award for narration of a Robeson documentary, star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, 1979, Grammy Hall of Fame, 1980, Paul Robeson House in Philadelphia, designated historic monument, 1991, College Football Hall of Fame. He was removed from all the lists of sports achievements. You'll still find books that don't have his name. That was 1995. Lifetime Achievement Grammy, 1998. Worldwide Celebrations and Academic Conferences for his 100th birthday, 1998. U.S. Postage Stamp, 2004. That's pretty good. Criterion Collection issues a box set of six Paul Robeson movies, 2007. U.S. Information Center in Jamaica, named in 2012. Paul Robeson Plaza, dedicated at Rutgers University, 2019. Paul Robeson Boulevard, a major avenue named in New Brunswick, New Jersey, July 2019. No, but it falls to us to truly rehabilitate him. He's still either forgotten. I mean, he was painted to the black radical community as too accommodating. He was painted to whites as too frightening. He still remains, there's still muffling him. His voice still isn't being heard.
Please talk about Paul's communism.
Well, something I just heard recently in regard to the pandemic really makes me think about the nature of Paul's communism and my own. This is, you know, people are saying this without anybody accusing them of being lefties. No one is safe until everyone is safe. They say that the scientific experts about us getting vaccinated, that's the essence of Paul's communism and my communism. No one is free from famine until we're all free from famine. Nobody is free from illiteracy until we're all literate. He believed that, and I believe that, and I think we've been made to forget, in spite of the tragedies of Russian communism, the achievements, and the achievements of Chinese communism. Everybody talks about Mao's famine. In studying Chinese history, they had famines all the time, horrible famines. That was the last famine. People lived three times as long as they ever did before. 95% of people are literate instead of 99% being illiterate. I'm not saying there aren't evils to communism, too, but Paul saw the achievements. And I think we've all grown up in an atmosphere of so much propaganda against communism that we fail to see how much it can accomplish. No one is safe until everyone is safe.
Sharon Rudall, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder. Your book, Ballad of an American, a graphic biography of Paul Robeson, is going to stand the test of time, not only for its intelligent writing, but for the beautiful artwork. And we're so grateful that you were able to produce this book for us. In the book, you write about Paul singing the wonderful song of solidarity, Joe Hill. And we want to share this song with our listeners. And before we do that, though, Heidi and I would like to thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder. Congratulations on your great book, and you be well.
Thank you. You be well, too.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake City, Joe says I, him standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I'm dead. Says Joe, but I'm dead. The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I didn't die. Says Joe, I didn't die.
The American people are enmeshed in and victimized by four overlapping, intertwined, and perhaps irreversible crises. They are medical, economic, racial, and political. The COVID-19 virus has infected over 25 million people here. It has killed at least 430,000 of us, and it rages on unchecked. Half the people in the United States are poor or near poor. 20 million or more are unemployed, and their numbers are growing. Hunger and homelessness are widespread. Racism has been institutionalized in our country ever since its founding as a white colonial state. Politically, except for the scattering of a few progressives, there really is no party or leadership that represents the interests of the vast majority of the American people. Former President Donald Trump has been impeached by the Democrats in the House and will stand trial in the Senate beginning the week of February 8th. He received 75 million votes in 2020, more than he received when he won in 2016. Even though he lost last November, his power is barely diminished. He will likely be acquitted of the charge of inciting an insurrection on January 6th. With the help of most of the 50 Republican senators, the Democrats won't be able to get the 60 necessary votes to convict him and prevent him from running for president again. Thus, he will continue to control the Republican Party. It is the possibility of his running again that keeps him as the powerful leader that he has become and keeps the Republicans in line, fearful as they are of being primaried and losing their own power and privilege. Only a few Republicans have shown the integrity and courage to oppose this venal, cruel, and cunning man. As the trial is about to begin, we speak with attorney Steve Rohde. He's a constitutional scholar, lecturer, writer, political activist, and retired civil rights lawyer. Steve Rohde is a founder and chair of Interfaith Communities United for Justice and Peace. He's the past president for the ACLU of Southern California and a past chair of Bend the Arc, a Jewish partnership for justice. He's the author of two books, American Words of Freedom, The Words That Define Our Nation, and the other book, Freedom of Assembly, and co-author of Foundations of Freedom, A Living History of Our Bill of Rights. Stephen Rohde has written for the Los Angeles Times, the Huffington Post, Truthout, and the American Prospect, and he's a regular contributor to the Los Angeles Review of Books. Attorney Stephen Rohde, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks very much, Michael. I'm really grateful to be on your show.
Steve, did former President Donald Trump commit an impeachable offense?
I believe so, Michael, and I think the facts, the law, and the Constitution support that. Impeachment is always a question of whether an individual has committed treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. This is judged by a standard to look at whether there has been an abuse of power by someone while serving in high office. In the case of the president, we have to judge it by the express promises and duties that a president takes on according to the Constitution. A president is obliged to faithfully execute the office of the President of the United States, to take care that the laws be faithfully executed, and to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. I'm probably going to say it a few times during this discussion that when we're looking at this article of impeachment for incitement of insurrection, we are not simply looking at his speech on January 6th at the rally he called before the attack on the Capitol. As the article of impeachment explains, we are looking at months of conduct by the President of the United States leading up to the insurrection, during the insurrection, and after the insurrection. I believe based on the founders' intent regarding impeachment, this is a almost classic case of abuse of political power. That's the power he was using as president to interfere The article of impeachment specifically mentions his call on January 2nd to the Secretary of State of Georgia, Brad Raffensperger, where he asked them to find enough votes to overturn the election. It speaks to all of the facts and circumstances throughout this period, and you and I will probably be dealing in more detail with respect to his incendiary speech on January 6th and what followed.
I wanted to ask you about that. Doesn't the First Amendment provide Trump with a defense for his speech? Former Harvard professor Alan Dershowitz has stated that, quote, nothing the president said constitutes unprotected incitement, as narrowly defined by the Supreme Court. Dershowitz said that, quote, it is beyond dispute, therefore, that his speech, disturbing as it may have been, is within the core protection of political speech. What's your reaction to Dershowitz's statement?
Well, this is a defense that the Trump legal team has posed. Yesterday, I read the 80-page brief by the House impeachment managers, signed by Jamie Raskin of the House. And I read the 14-page brief by Trump's new lawyers. I really encourage anyone listening to our conversation to go look up those documents. The House brief is historical. It's legal, but it is readable. It gathers all of the evidence in one place, and I think it's worth a few minutes for anyone to read. I can't be complimentary to the brief filed by Trump's lawyers because it's disjointed. It cites no case law or history. It has typos, which is regrettable in any legal brief. But it does address the question you've raised. And there is an argument that Dershowitz and others and Trump's lawyers are making that his speech was protected by the First Amendment. Now, I think we got to take that argument head on because you and I may do a future show someday when there is a Black Lives Matter rally and there is powerful and strong speech being espoused. Or we may look at other moments when people, frankly, across the political spectrum are using fiery language. So I do not want the Trump impeachment to set any kind of precedent, and I think there are serious reasons to distinguish the Trump case from anything else because of his unique status. As far as the First Amendment is concerned, in 1969, there was a pivotal case called Brandenburg versus Ohio. The facts in that case are quite dramatic. A bunch of Ku Klux Klan white-hooded men with firearms and burning crosses went out in a rural area in Ohio. The leader called for the crowd to take revenge against Jews, and he used the N-word. And those supporting them and claim that our president, our Congress, our Supreme Court continues to suppress the white Caucasian race, and he announced plans for a march on Washington to take place shortly on the 4th of July. And another speaker advocated forced expulsion of African Americans to Africa and Jews to Israel. The United States Supreme Court found that all of that speech was protected by the First Amendment, and they announced a rule which applies to this day and applies to Trump if he were viewed as a private citizen. And that standard says the following, that to be suppressed or criminalized, speech must be directed at inciting or producing imminent lawless action and is likely to incite or produce such action. All of those elements have to be present. And I believe when you look at the history of Donald Trump's speech and conduct throughout the 77 days leading up to this, the kinds of statements he made, that he promised a wild rally on January 6th, that he told the crowd to fight like hell or you're not going to have a country anymore. You'll never take back your country with weakness. You have to show strength. You have to be strong. And then his conduct during the event. He stood silent for some hours, and this comes into his duty as a president to protect the Constitution. He retweeted his speech at 1:49 p.m. and said, "Our country has had enough. We will not take it back, and we will not take it anymore. And that's what this is all about. You have to be strong." He said those words during the insurrection. He took no action until 2:38 p.m. when he gave a cover-up video saying, "We love you. You're very special. I know how you feel. Go home and go home in peace." Finally, he said that. So I think it's clear to me that when you judge this in the context of the President of the United States, you have to realize, and this is a point being missed by some in the media and others, but it's brought out in the House impeachment brief. The First Amendment does not protect government officials from accountability for their abuses in office. President Bush at the time was not a private citizen. This is closer to an employment action of removing an employee, in which case there's a case called Garcetti versus Sabalos in 2006, where a district attorney in L.A. did not have, quote, First Amendment rights to make certain statements that undermined the confidence of his office. So when you think of it in context, I do not believe that the impeachment of former President Trump violates the First Amendment. And if I may say so, I do not believe any future criminal proceedings brought by the Department of Justice or the D.C. authorities would violate the First Amendment.
We're speaking with Attorney Stephen Rohde. Steve, can Trump be convicted and disqualified from running for president again after he's left office?
Yes. This is the second line of defense that we're hearing from the Trump defense team. Fortunately, 150 well-established legal authorities from both political parties, the Congressional Research Service, an independent research service within Congress that looks at issues, have all decided that, yes, you can prosecute by impeachment an individual after they have left office. Now, when you say those words, a lot of Americans flinch because we think of impeachment as the means by which someone is removed from office. And removal from office, of course, is an important element of impeachment. But the Constitution contains a second remedy to protect democracy, and that is to disqualify any person who is impeached from holding federal office. And the research on this is quite strong and quite clear. And there are specific examples of federal officials being impeached and tried in the Senate after they have left office. That happened to Senator William Blunt in 1797. It happened to Secretary of War William Belknap in 1876. And all of this is against the British precedent of Warren Hastings in England, who was tried for impeachment after he left office. And there's some strong logic and constitutional language and structure to that. No official and no president gets a January free pass to commit high crimes and misdemeanors in January, a month before they're leaving office, and then cannot be held accountable. The House brief had a quote that I found quite telling from John Quincy Adams in 1846. He said, "I hold myself, so long as I have the breath of life in my body, amenable to impeachment by the House for everything I did during the time I held any public office." That was the mentality of the founders who wrote that Constitution, meaning Quincy's father, and it was the solid precedent of history. And I think while the Senate lawyers for Trump will broadcast this argument, and it's a political question in the Senate whether they will get those 67 votes, I think as a matter of law and Constitution, it's entirely proper to be putting a former president up on trial at this time.
Trump's original team of defense lawyers quit last week. They had planned to argue that impeaching a past president is unconstitutional, but Trump forbade this defense. He wanted them to argue that the election was stolen by voter fraud. They would not do this, and they quit. What do you think of Trump's strategy? Constitutional law professor Jonathan Turley has said that this strategy would be self-immolation. Do you agree?
Well, there is some self-immolation going on now in the Senate because Trump found lawyers to parrot his argument. In their short 14-page brief, they argue that Trump had a good faith belief that the election was stolen. They are contesting the premise of the article of impeachment that he was attempting to overthrow a lawful election. It appears that he's found lawyers who will do his bidding to argue on the floor of the Senate and re-argue the entire question of the legitimacy of the election. I think in that sense, he is perpetuating the very abuse that he stands accused of, but he found lawyers this time who will be his mouthpiece on that argument.
So when this new team of defense lawyers argue this, are they opening themselves up to ethical violations? After all, 60 different courts ruled against this argument. Would they face ethics complaints, court sanctions, and libel suits for pursuing fraud claims with no basis?
Yeah, this is a very good question, and the broader question could be of all the lawyers who have peddled these arguments throughout the period after the election. Frankly, you and I, as attorneys, I'm retired, you're still active. I am cautious about going after lawyers. Lawyers are expected to zealously defend their clients, but they're supposed to do so within the law or a reasonable extension of the law and of the facts. I think at this late date, it's reprehensible for members of the bar to be advancing this argument, just as it was reprehensible during the earlier period for lawyers to do that. I doubt, given the nature of the Senate as a political body, that the lawyers for Trump on this occasion will be sanctioned, but I do believe sanctions of that kind should rest elsewhere.
I just wanted to say, Steve, that like you, I am also retired. I tell people I'm really not retired, I'm repurposed. But what I'm doing lately is mostly this radio show and some working and not practicing, and happy to be doing what I'm doing. Let me ask you about Rudolph Giuliani along the lines that we've been talking about. Many prestigious judges and lawyers have complained to the New York Supreme Court about Rudolph Giuliani's conduct when he was the lead attorney for Donald Trump, and Giuliani put forward the baseless charge that the election was stolen. They have requested that he be suspended from the practice of law. Do you think he should be?
In his case, I do. His case is an example of going into courts, making frivolous and groundless arguments. In federal court, there is something called Rule 11. Every time a lawyer appears in court or signs a pleading, he or she is certifying that there is a factual basis to their arguments and a legal basis. Rudy Giuliani breached that standard repeatedly across the country. He did so in New York and elsewhere. I believe disciplinary proceedings are well-founded. And I will add that at that very rally on January 6th, it was Rudy Giuliani, a few minutes before Trump appeared, who said, we need trial by combat. It is Giuliani who should be added as a co-conspirator in any seditious conspiracy and insurrection charges that are brought for conspiracy to foment those events. And again, I hope the Department of Justice and the authorities in D.C. are looking at Giuliani for criminal charges arising out of that, and elsewhere suitable bodies are looking at disciplinary charges against him as a lawyer. He exceeded lawful, zealous advocacy in repeatedly making false statements to courts across this country, and he needs to be held accountable for that.
Do you think that if Trump's acquitted, this will be a loss for the democracy and the rule of law in our country?
I worry about that. He was acquitted on the previous impeachment. But I think it was right and proper for the House to have impeached on the first occasion, and I believe it's right and proper for the House to have impeached on this occasion. History has a long memory. We're going to have to look back at this period. If what Trump did in those 77 days leading up to the insurrection is not impeachable, then what is? No lesser a constitutional authority than Mitt Romney said that. So I think it's right that each part of our democracy and our constitutional system plays their proper role without triangulating and second-guessing themselves about some future political impact. It is the senators who have to be held accountable in light of this evidence and the law. It is Republicans in the Senate who need to come to grips with this moment in our history, and they can look no farther than Representative Liz Cheney of their political party, who said the President of the United States summoned this mob, assembled the mob, and lit the flame of this attack. Everything that followed was his doing. In her terms, that is exactly right. And if we had senators who acted out of conscience and independence far more than the 17 Republicans needed, this should be an overwhelming vote to prevent Donald Trump from ever serving office in a federal position, and he should be stripped of his pension and other emoluments, if I can use that word, that he will receive as a former president. Whatever the political reaction, whatever the reaction of his inflamed QAnon conspiracy theorists and white supremacist supporters do as a result of his acquittal, that remains to be seen, and we are certainly not over the impact of that whole part of our country.
Yeah, well, that leads me to my next question, Steve, and this is what's so awfully troubling to me. Trump last week announced the establishment of what he calls the Office of the Former President. This is in line with his assertion that the election was stolen. It appears that he's setting up a dual power situation, that he's not going anywhere. Your thoughts on the office of the former president?
Yes. I haven't heard the office of a former president. Former presidents open libraries, and they're certainly politically active, as we've seen Barack Obama and George Bush. So there's no prohibition on former presidents being politically active in their future. The danger is the unprecedented nature of Trump's presidency and post-presidency period. I have deep concerns about the political base he is building, about his continuing willingness to inflame his base. He has never, despite a few random speeches and rehearsed videos, he has never come to grips with what he caused on January 6th. And I think he is in a position to do great harm to this country going forward. And I believe the founders were visionary in including disqualification from future office as a remedy for impeachment. And if there was anyone who needed to officially be disqualified from future office, it's Donald Trump. I'm proud to be writing regularly for the Los Angeles Review of Books. I have posted a review of the book After Trump, a brilliant book by a Democrat and Republican lawyers who are looking at how do we repair the damage of caused by Trump. And we also, I look at the whole question of whether Trump should be criminally prosecuted now that he has left office. So people can go to LA Review of Books, check me out as a contributor. I have a new book review on free speech. You and I should do another show on that question coming up.
That's Rohde, R-O-H-D-E. Stephen Rohde. Steve, before we have to let you go, I wanted to ask you about the situation with Julian Assange. I know you've been a leader in his defense, and can you bring us up to date on the newest developments? We've got only a few minutes, but I think this is an important thing to talk about.
Well, I've been joining you, Michael, in that defense, which is greatly appreciated. The British judge on the extradition petition of the United States government to try to bring Assange to America to try him under the Espionage Act of 1917, facing 175 years in prison, the judge found that because of Assange's mental health being so fragile and the risk of suicide, he should not be extradited. So the bottom line was a victory for him, but unfortunately the British judge included a lot of extraneous findings contrary to freedom of the press. She denied various defenses that Assange's team put up under international law and domestic law. I'm very troubled by that opinion sitting on the books in England. There will be appeals through the British system and then to the European Court of Human Rights, and we're very hopeful that that section of the opinion will be vacated, but that he will not be extradited and he can leave custody, recover his health, and do the important work at WikiLeaks that he's been doing in the past.
Thank you, Stephen Rohde. Thank you very much for being on Law & Disorder. You take it easy, and we'll check in with you later on to continue this discussion. You be well.
Thank you. I'm very proud of this show, and I'm grateful to be on.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.